Evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB. John and Dick attempt to be the net control operators, interlocutors, moderators, whatever you want to call us, for this educational thing we call the Technical Net, which has been around now for 30 years. This is TechNet number 4,132 of the series that began in September of 1982, way back in the dark ages. Major purpose of the TechNet, you guys have heard this before, is for education. We amateurs gather most Sunday evenings and we try to educate each other as to how all this equipment works. Lot to be learned. There was a little bit of a mini lecture late last week on how transformers work from my point of view, slightly different point of view. And if you go to the website of Bernie, K2YO, which I think is called Bernie at huntfamily.org or huntfamily.com, I think it's .org, you'll see a web address you can go to where we've discovered this week a very nice lecture being given by a professor at MIT, which is what he calls a mind blower. Let me drop. It's a 9.5 minute lecture on what looks like Kirchhoff's law, or looks like Faraday's law. In other words, he's got a battery and two resistors, and he makes voltage drop by Ohm's law measurements across the two resistors. Then he eliminates the battery and plugs in a device that makes a magnetic field. The battery was a 1-volt battery. He plugs in the device that gives 1 volt of magnetic field, 1 volt in the loop of the two resistors, and he starts making measurements with the exact same voltmeter. And he gets readings that are, at first, a mind blower. And once you understand what's going on there, you have gone one or two steps down range of understanding how a transformer works. Because a transformer with resistors in a loop that has a magnetic field being generated, a changing magnetic field, a transformer-like circuit does not obey Kirchhoff's law. It only obeys Faraday's law. And he goes into a little bit of an explanation of that. Very well done lecture. That whole series of lectures by MIT, the physics department, are extremely well done. So you'll get an introduction to those if you go to Bernie's website. So later on tonight, after 9 o'clock, we may be discussing that particular subject. Let me drop. Before then and now, our major purpose is that for the first hour, for those who sign in with questions or comments for the TechNet, John and I make a sincere effort to at least give a brief answer during that first hour so that, in theory, a person signing in doesn't have to wait longer than an hour to get an answer. For those who can't stay up late and real good information they find out goes on later on, there's a way you can get to that. And that is almost all of these TechNet sessions are thoroughly recorded by Mike Perry, KC2NJI. And if you go to his website at www.amateurradio.tangovictor, you go to that particular website and the last 6.5 years of TechNets are recorded. So this particular TechNet within the next couple of days will probably appear on that website, and therefore what some people will do is to download that into some kind of a recording device, and while they're on the train going to work or driving to work, they listen to their tape recorder, or the modern day equivalent of that, and listen to the things that are beyond the hours where they can't stay up that late. And that's also the method by which we get peer review. In other words, John and I make a sincere effort to give you accurate information. Everybody has got a batting average that's less than 1,000. So occasionally an error creeps in, and somebody will listen to that website or listen to the broadcast, so to speak, directly and say, hey, I disagree with you guys. They'll send us an email, a snail mail, or they'll accost us on the air and say, hey, you guys are wrong here. And when that happens, we bring that to your attention. So, in theory, the information eventually becomes corrected if there is an error. It says here. Okay. A person who's going to sign in, let me drop. I still got a little bit of this cold. A person who signs into the TechNet, because he does have a question or a comment, does so by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. So a typical sign-in might sound like KC2BHY, G Jim and Yes. And Jim is a frequent sign-in from Port Washington. So give us your call letter's name and the word Yes if you do have a question or a comment. And do so right now. KQLIW listening.
Jim and Yes.
Enter XCN. Wesley, and I would like you to continue with the transformers in the scientific part of it. But also I have something that is very much like what you prefer. Microwave and malt. Enter XCN.
Okay, so far we've got Jim and Wes who signed in. I think I heard Freddie earlier. Freddie, do you have a question or a comment tonight? Do you want to sign in? Or anyone else who wants to sign in, give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW.
WS2N,
Paul.
Space report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine. Paul's got a space report. Anyone else to check in, give me your call letters and name right now.
32, VBN, listening. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, that sounds like Freddie. Hey, Freddie, you did have a question a couple of weeks ago that we never got to. You're allowed to pose that question tonight if you want to. Back to you, Freddie.
Okay, Roger, I wanted to know, how could I take my smartphone and from the internet go into the TV set and have a picture, watch movies from my smartphone into my 50-inch TV set.
Wow. Okay. So your phone service, which does give you movie capability, you're really asking how to get that onto a television screen. That's a tough one, and that's an area that I know nothing about. Is anyone on frequency?
Okay.
Does anyone on frequency know how Freddie could take his internet service on his cell phone and make that picture appear on his television screen? Give me your call letters right now if you've got some information for Freddie. K2LIW listening.
K2J.
Okay, I heard Eric. Go right ahead, Eric, and tell us how to do that.
So, there's a number of ways of doing it. If you have cable service or Fios, they actually offer an app that lets you do just that. Fios has a program which runs on a computer which you can download your pictures on, and there's an app within the cable box or the Fios box to pick up those files and display those pictures on the TV. Cablevision has a similar type of service, so not as hard as you think.
So let me double check now, Eric. If I understand correctly, whoever is your internet provider, most of those internet providers, I think you're saying, do have a application that you can request that when you download it, allows you to make contact between your cell phone and the television screen. The actual wiring between the two, wait a minute now, if he's already got Cablevision or Fios, fiber optic cable television service, so I think you're saying there's a way of connecting to the internet service and bringing that into the cable service. So I guess you're saying no real interconnect wiring from the cell phone to the television set is required. I probably have that a bit mixed up. I'm going to send it back to you, Eric. KE2EJ, a little bit of noise on your signal. K2LIW in the TechNet. Oh, no, you sound good.
Yeah, K2LIW, K2J, and it sounds like we have that Echolink person who has the problem, and we'll wind up discombobulating him again. Not quite right, Dick. If you have DSL, this isn't going to happen. If you have either Cablevision or Fios, they have a media manager program which will run on your PC. You essentially download your picture from your cell phone to your PC, And from the PC, it will display using a media manager client, which is in the cable box or the Fios box to display on your TV. It's free of charge, no additional charges for it. Basically, it works within the router of the home. You have to be within your local land, so to speak, in order for this to work. So, you know, Cablevision has been advertising. You can watch your TV on your iPod or on your iPhone, and same thing with Fios, and it's all part of that same system. K2IW, K2J.
Okay, you can watch TV on your iPod, but he's now trying to go the other way around. What he normally downloads to the iPod, he wants to appear on TV. So I think you're saying that with the right software downloaded from your cell phone, your cable TV provider is where I think it's coming from. They allow you to do this bi-directional interconnect. Is that approximately it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
As part of the service of watching on your iPhone or your TV, your iPad rather, or your Android, which is generally over Wi-Fi, okay, you have a local router in your home, they have a media manager, a program which resides on a PC. And what you would do is download your pictures to the PC and set it up as a file, just like you would store any of your picture file. And it allows, there's a program that runs on your PC that allows your TV set to open any of those picture files and display them on the TV. So, yeah, it's bi-directional in that sense, but not the way you're describing it. The services, the selling point is, watch your TV on your iPhone or your iPad or your wireless device within your home. And as a plus, we'll let you display your files on your TV. Got it?
And you're asking if I've got it. I'm not much of a computer person, so I don't quite have it. But the original guy who asked the question was Freddie. And Freddie, I can tell this is not super simple. To a person who's very computer savvy, it's simple to them. To me, it's not. And Freddie, you probably got some more questions on this. And even if you don't get your complete answer tonight, you're allowed to come back next week and ask the question again. Go right ahead there, Freddie. That's the VBN, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Freddie.
Hey, this is KB2, VBN. I have hot wire TV, and you're saying I could take the laptop and connect it to the cable system, and they let me watch my movies for free from the laptop?
That's for you, Eric. K2EJ, go right ahead.
Yeah, if you've got Time Warner, Cablevision, or Fios, they have an app that will let you watch the movies, like it'll let you watch HBO on your PC, iPod, or iPhone, or Android. They'll let you do that. And you can do the reverse. You can play your pictures, your JPEGs, and your GIFs on your TV if you load the appropriate app on your computer.
Back to you, Freddie. If you need any further fills in that, go right ahead. You got it, Freddie.
Hey, Roger. I'm going to call up the cable company and ask them how I can set it up there. That sounds good. This is KB2VBN. Thank you for the information. I'll let the net continue to the next man.
WS Glenn, does he have Cablevision?
I don't think he does. Freddie, is it Cablevision that you have? Over to you, Freddie.
I got DirecTV. DirecTV.
So it's DirecTV. Go ahead, Paul. You have some comments?
Okay, I thought he had cable TV. I do it with cable. In the direction where you're going from, you know, whatever you have for a cable service onto a tablet, I do that, or onto a phone. But not the other way around. I haven't seen that yet. But if he's got DirecTV, I think that's going to be a problem. Thank you.
Actually, DirecTV has a service, but they charge for it.
Okay, so you're doing at least in one particular direction, Paul. Paul, tell us how you get your cable TV service to appear on your tablet or iPad. Is it a downloadable program? Is it something you have to set up ahead of time? Do you have to store it on your computer in some way? How do you actually carry it out, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
You got to get it from iTunes for an iPad. And also, there's always select programs to let you use.
Okay, that's Eric's answer. And Paul, tell us how you've actually done it, Paul, and how well it works.
Okay, in fact, I just turned channel 12 off right before tonight. The tablet, what you do is you go on, you know, you have a, if it's an Android device, which most of them are now, you go to the Amazon store, and you search for Optimum app, and Optimum is, you know, for Cablevision, and you download that for free, and inside of a couple of seconds, it's on your tablet or on your phone, whichever device you have. In my case, a tablet. And then with that, you go onto your regular computer. You need to sign in, you know, with your username and password into for this thing to work. You know, you need to have an email with Optimum. Once you have the email and you know, you have your password, and you go back onto your tablet and you put that in the app. You know, you bring up the app. It's going to ask you for your username and your password. You put that in, and then that's all you have to do. It comes right up, which is very good. I mean, you know, I have no problem. Whatever service you get, your box will come on. You know, if you get HBO, well, you'll get HBO. If you got, you know, if you just got your basic, that's what you're going to get. Whatever you get on your box, that's what you're going to get on your tablet. Back to you, Dick.
When that downloadable movie, let's assume that it's an HBO movie that I really liked, and I wanted to be able to see it when I decide to, on my iPhone or on my tablet, I presume it's coming to me by way of the cell phone-like service. Therefore, I'm assuming I'm using up those minutes per month of my cell phone service when I'm doing that. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
That's completely wrong, Dick.
Dick, do you want me to say it, or do you want Eric to?
Let's talk to Eric, Jeremy. Go ahead, Eric.
Fine, let me explain the way this works. This is something called MoCA. It's called Modem Over Cable. Right? It's a particular protocol, and it's real time. So whatever is on HBO runs now, you can see on your Android or iPod. Right? It's a real time streaming. Slightly different than the way we stream over the internet. And generally, it works via Wi-Fi locally within, I don't know about Cablevision, whether they let you go outside, I don't think so. I think you have to be within the range of your particular cable modem and your Wi-Fi device. It also works with wired Ethernet, where it's still coming locally from your cable modem. Most people don't realize that cable modems actually operate under this protocol called MoCA. And in terms of Cablevision is usually DOCSIS 2 or DOCSIS 3, which is a particular protocol. Some stations you're not going to get because they don't license it, so to speak, for that type of delivery. The call can probably tell you whether it works outside or not. So, basically, it's an extended screen of your TV set, so to speak, within the confines of your home. K2RIW, K3J.
Okay, so during the time that I'm receiving this on my portable handheld device, it is a Wi-Fi-like connection to my Wi-Fi system in my home. The actual playback is taking place from my desktop computer, so to speak. That's what's actually supplying the raw data real-time. It's playing over that Wi-Fi circuit into my handheld device when I'm in the range of my Wi-Fi device at my home. If I then climb onto the train and drive to New York City, I believe I do not have that capability unless there was some kind of a way that it could be stored on my tablet or iPad. Is that iPhone? Is that approximately it, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Eric, do you want me to take it?
Yeah, one more second. Yes, you've got a good imagination. You wish. First of all, they don't let you store it. You can't store it and play it back at another point in time. The way it's licensed is real time. What's on Channel 2 now is what you get, period. You can't store it, you can't play it back. Real time. You don't have to use your computer. It's basically coming Wi-Fi out of your cable modem to your device. And in the day of digital cable, let me make a drop quiz, then time out. In the day since digital cable came around, because it didn't work during the analog cable, the digital cable stream itself is in this MoCA format, which is used on the box that you use to convert those signals to your TV set. Your cable box gives you HDMI, it gives you component out. It's actually taking in this MoCA format as you select the channel. The Wi-Fi router, or the router where the cable comes in from the cable modem, and the cable modem has a router built in. Depending upon what you bought, you either have wired Ethernet or you have wired Ethernet and Wi-Fi. It's the Wi-Fi connection to your portable device that picks up this stream and lets you display it. It's a display device, not a device that records or plays back or any of those kinds of things. Paul, you can tell him that my guess is it doesn't work outside because that would violate a lot of the rules in terms of the material. Although Cablevision does own a lot of the services, so they may extend that because they have all their hotspots every, 5,000 feet out in the world. Pick it up, Paul, and set things straight. Can you do that?
WS2N, you've got it, Paul. KQRIW. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, very good, Eric. And it's a Wi-Fi 802.11 Belkin box that I have. 802.11N, which is like the latest one. It's got like some kind of dual antennas in there, and it turns out my tablet also has that. So I've never seen any pixelating. I've never seen any hang-ups or anything. It really works good. And on top of that, I guess the tablet is an HD picture, so the picture is just phenomenal. It happens to have very good sound too, by the way. So the picture is, like he says, you can leave your computer off in the house. The only reason you need the home computer is really to, set up your email. You can't set that up through a tablet or a phone. You need to do that through your base computer. So you can shut that thing off and leave it. It's like he says, it's coming through the modem, coming through your Wi-Fi setup. And of course, you do have to have a Wi-Fi setup. But if you have a tablet, you're going to want a Wi-Fi setup for your house. Otherwise, that's 90% of what you're going to use it for. You're going to use your tablet to get on the internet and everything else. And now you could receive TV. As far as going away from home, now they have TV to go. Let me drop it to the east. It went down. Sounds like the CNN went down. Let me drop for a longer period of time. Hopefully that works. They have, Cablevision now has TV to go. I haven't heard that Fios or Time Warner has this yet, but it might. And what this is you can go to any of the hotspots. Right now, I can go to any hotspot with my computer and get on the internet.
and there's like 50,000 hotspots through the tri-state area. And no problem, of course, doing that. But now with the TV, there are certain stations that are licensed to do this with cable. And I haven't downloaded the apps yet for them, but fresh in my mind, it's CNN, Fox News, Cartoon Network, Channel 12 News, what's the other one? The Yankee game, the Yankee station just signed up. That's going to be big. So, there might be a couple more. Oh, yeah, Showtime is involved with that, too. So, what happens is you go on the Internet and you have to get an individual app for each of these stations to go. And once you put that app in, then you'll put your password in, you'll put your username in when you're in these hotspots, and you'll be able to watch whatever app you're bringing up. It's not the optimum app that does it. So if you want to watch CNN, you know, 100 miles away in a hotspot, bring up the CNN app, and you'll be able to watch it. So that's the way they have it set up. Maybe there's a dozen different stations that you can do this with right now. Dick, back to your WS2M.
Yeah, it's something to that. Yeah, I've got a series of questions on this one, but go ahead, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW, wait for the beeps. K2RIW, K2EJ. Independent of Cablevision and DirecTV and all these other things, were Time Warner the one who originated? It was originally called HBO Go. And essentially, it's a streaming service. If you subscribe to HBO, you subscribe through your cable provider, or through DSL, or through DirecTV, or Echost, or any of the methods in which you pay for the HBO service, you download HBO Go, and essentially you sign in with an email address and a password that you use on your cable provider, or your Fios provider, or whomever provider. It doesn't have to be Wi-Fi. As long as you can get into the public Internet, and you have HBO Go loaded on your computer, Wi-Fi, iPhone, whatever, you can view their stream. So they're not, it's not like you're selecting a stream from a group of streams. You're essentially connecting to a server at HBO, or you're connecting to a server at CNN. You're connecting to a server at Cinemax. So it's traditional Internet connection. Doesn't have to be Wi-Fi, it can be wired. As long as you're on the public Internet and you download their particular program and you have a legitimate paid-for subscription in your cable or satellite provider, you're entitled to view their stream. K2RIW, K2J.
It's slowly becoming a little bit clearer. Now, Freddie has asked one hell of a question here yet tonight. And by the way, for those who wondered, because Freddie signed in a couple of weeks ago and we didn't handle him, that's why he went to the top of the list tonight. That's our fairness system, so to speak. Paul, when you download this material, when you're operating on your Wi-Fi of your house into your tablet, I presume you could walk within 100 feet of your property lines and still be getting it. I have the impression you also have the ability to drive 100 miles away and by way of Internet connection of that particular service to get it. And my next question would be, if I get on my airliner and I fly to California with that same Internet connection, I'm guessing I could get that particular program live at that time. A bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's correct, Dick.
Not quite. Let me drop it. I heard the ID. I thought that was the courtesy zone. No, it's two separate systems. That's the whole deal. One at home, you're hooked up to your Wi-Fi system, and you have one app from Cablevision. I must get 200 different channels I could go to on my system. Whatever you get at home, that's what you're going to get on your either your cell phone or your tablet. I could walk around, I could put it in my backyard, I could set a tent up, I could watch it in the backyard if I want, I could watch
in the front yard, a couple of, maybe 150 feet away. That depends on how good your Wi-Fi setup is. You know, you don't want to put your Wi-Fi transmitter in the basement. And, you know, the second you go out of the house, you might not make it to your patio. So that's the one system. The other system, let me drop it. Separate individual apps, like Eric was saying. There's an app for CNN, an app for HBO, an app for Showtime, an app for the Cartoon Network. These, you know, an app for Channel 12. You have to individually download, you know, each app for that particular station, and that's the one that works to go. You know, if I'm going to go 100 miles away, yeah, or any hot spot, then I would bring up that CNN app, and I would be able to watch that. You cannot bring up the Optimum app that you use at home, which is going to give me the hundreds of channels of my whatever service I have. That won't work. It won't work. You need these individual apps. Like I said, maybe there's a half a dozen or a dozen different channels that have that out there right now. But that's pretty much the story on that. So you go to a hotspot, and then you can watch those if you download the apps. I haven't tried that yet, but you know, I'll give it a shot probably within another month or so. Back to you there.
Okay, now once I go to that individual app that gives me hotspot internet connection, so I hop on the airliner, I'll fly over to San Francisco, find a hotspot, go to that particular app for that particular application on the internet, and watch that particular program there on my iPad, tablet, or whatever. So one application at a time, one service at a time, and if one of those services happens to be News 12, I'm a little skeptical of this, could I, in theory, be watching Long Island News 12 while I'm sitting in a coffee shop in San Francisco? WS2N, K2RIW.
No. Let me drop it. You have these hotspots. You bring up the... You can bring it up on your computer. You don't have to be a member of Cablevision. You bring up the hotspots that they have, and it's the tri-state area. You know, that's what they show. That's the ones that you could use. And it's countless hotspots all throughout Long Island, New York. Looks like part of northern New Jersey, maybe more. I don't know. Definitely upstate. You know, all the way up Route 9 and all into Connecticut. And they have these, like, if you zoom in on the map, they look like these, like, blue hazes surrounding all these different areas where you could receive it. And then they have solid-looking ones where you know, they're indoor ones. You know, you might go into a store or something, and they actually have it there. But you don't need that. I mean, I could drive to my parking lot there. I could drive me, pull in, and the whole parking lot is lit up, no problem. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, I get the impression it only works for the tri-state area. Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW, go right ahead.
Yeah, well, I'm not a Cablevision subscriber, so I can't say for sure what Paul is saying. Sounds like what Cablevision would do is that where there is a Cablevision service is where you can pick it up from a Wi-Fi, because Cablevision has thousands. If you look on the cable, you'll see there's boxes there with antennas, and those are the Wi-Fi hotspots, where is it? They would contain that within their own system. But HBO Go, CNN, Showtime, all these various other services, you can get them anywhere around the world where there's an internet connection. It doesn't have to be Wi-Fi. I can be in California, which I have, and watch HBO. I can be in Florida, which I have, and watch CNN, and so on and so forth, because it is a traditional internet service, a streaming service. MPEG-4 is actually H.264 specific. It looks to see what kind of bandwidth you're getting and modifies the stream appropriately, so you get a fairly decent picture. So Cablevision being, or Optimum Television, as they call it themselves now, being its own entity as far as, you know, News 12 goes, although I suspect They're also available on the public internet. Whereas what Paul is talking about is strictly Wi-Fi, and what I'm talking about isn't limited to Wi-Fi. So all these other services are traditional internet services like Hulu or Vudu or YouTube, you can get from any place in the world. KTYWK210.
I'm slowly catching on, but here's the tough question now, Eric. Assume that I have fallen in love with News 12 of Long Island, and I'm now stationed in California. To your knowledge, is there a way that I could get live News 12 of Long Island while I'm sitting in a hotel room or a coffee shop in California? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I directly don't have the answer to that, but, you know, with a phone call to my friend over at Cablevision, I could give you an answer. I don't know if they're on the public internet or they just contain themselves within their own system. And by the way, there are Cablevision systems all over the place, not just in the tri-state area. Believe it or not, the Dolans own the system in London. So I suspect if you were in London, you'd be able to get it. That is, if they VPN within their own system. I don't have the answer to that. But these other services, like HBO, CNN, and so on and so forth, they're on the public internet. You've got an internet connection, be it Wi-Fi, be it Ethernet cable, what have you, you can hook up to them.
Good information, and I thank you, Eric. Eric, in the last few days, we've been on the news programs that the Consumer Electronics Show, which I guess is in Las Vegas or someplace like that. Quite often in the past, you've attended those consumer electronic shows and came back and told us what's coming over the horizon. I wonder if you had a chance to go this year, and if so, what did you see? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, unfortunately for me, I don't get to go anymore since the economic downturn. K2RIW, K2EJ. But you can, if you're really interested, you can follow what's going on there. It's definitely over now. Via the internet, and if you watch some channels like G4 TV, they show you what's hot and what's not. There's a lot of good stuff happening, but the biggies like Microsoft and Apple and all those people chose not to spend their money there this year. Although they're now showing 4K and 8K TVs, you know, super high-definition television. And, you know, there's a lot of that stuff going on, and there's the internet-connected TVs, and then there's more robotics, and there's a whole lot of stuff. I do miss going to the show. The show is an interesting phenomenon to go to. It's in Las Vegas, and actually this year it's not only in this convention center, it's also in the Las Vegas Hilton, and in the Venetian, and a few other places. So it's pretty big. But a lot of the big players are missing this year. K2IWK, to eject.
That's good to know, Eric. You have three-dimensional television in your house. When I was at Best Buy, I saw a demonstration where you put on the fancy glasses. I think the glasses are polarized clockwise right eye and counterclockwise left eye or something like that. I wonder if that's the particular type of 3D television display that you have in your house. Last question, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, the latest left eye, right eye. Were the displays themselves, each television pixel has the appropriate polarization on each pixel. That's the way of the world, so to speak, these days. It's less expensive to produce now in terms of the screen for mass production, as opposed to what I have is photochromic glasses, which shutters left eye, right eye. I like what I have. It works quite nice. The circularly polarized glasses, you can actually go to the movie theater, watch the 3D thing. Instead of putting the glasses back in the return the glasses container, you can take it home and use them on your circularly polarized 3D TV. So that's the coming way of the world. It actually gives you better isolation between left eye and right eye than some of the earlier shutter glasses, and the problem was not necessarily the speed of the photochromic material within the glasses themselves. The problems were actually the refresh rate of the screen, which was quite fast enough, it gave you a little bit of fringing and those things. P2IWK, to the gentleman.
Very good information, Eric. So the speed of the screen is what created a little bit of smearing between left eye and right eye on the photochromic cyclic glasses. And I guess maybe if you use just your left eye and blinked your right eye, you would see a little bit of flicker at first, but I'm pretty sure the way the human being adapts, very similar to watching 50 hertz television in the United Kingdom, at first you see flicker. But within the first half hour, the brain readjusts, and there is no flicker except in the peripheral vision. Okay, we're getting off subject. We've been keeping Jim waiting. And Jim, hope you're allowed to stay up this late. KC2BHY, the experimenter, electronic experimenter of Port Washington. Go ahead, Jim. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me throw at you that there's no flicker. It's not 30 hertz, 60 hertz. The eyeballs are seeing 120 hertz. Too fast to look at this.
Impressive. Go ahead, Jim.
Hey, Dick. I just had a question that I kind of related to my question last week. I have my DS520S here, and I tried to make a contact with it today, but I was having a little trouble because I was trying to tune it, and I wasn't worried about destroying the output tubes, but I tried to use the tuner, and I know how to use the tuner, and the tuner wasn't working. The SWR was going down, 1 watt, and it was at about 60 watts reflected, and I was just wondering what might be going on.
Yeah, one of the things we discussed last week, Jim, is that the Kenwood TS-520 has a real tuning and loading control, a real Pi network on the output tank circuit of those transmitting tubes, 6146 tubes. As such, with rare exception, that rig requires no tuner, no external antenna tuner, matchbox, whatever you call it. You could completely bypass the matchbox, take it out of the system, connect the antenna directly to that TS-520, and we are guessing that 90% of the time it will work, only in an extreme case of a very high standing ratio antenna might you need the antenna tuner. So you could make your life a lot simpler by not using the antenna tuner with that 520 on your HF antenna. Because learning to tune and load properly the 520, that in itself is a bit of a learning curve. To properly tune and load the 520 and properly set the adjustments on the matchbox antenna tuner, now that's a bit of a combination. It's a little bit like telling a person you're going to learn to swim by being thrown into the rapids. That's a little bit too big of a bite at first from my point of view, Jim. So I think you should try running the barefoot Kenwood 520 straight into your antenna with no antenna tuner. So that was one of our suggestions last week. When you get a chance to try it that way, I think there's a 90% chance you're going to be pleasantly surprised. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'll try it. I'm just kind of worried about damaging it, but I'll definitely try that tonight.
I think you passed it over to me, and I wanted to make sure. Yeah, I recommend you do, because you were worried about damaging the transmitter, and you'd have to do something pretty extreme, like no antenna there at all, and you run a key down for 60 solid seconds, and by then you'd be overheating the final tubes, and you would be artificially aging them, but you probably would not really damage them. In other words, if you're making, pressing the key down for a couple of seconds, letting it up for a couple of seconds during the tuning procedure, under those circumstances, you could have an antenna that's a dead short or a dead open circuit, and you would not damage that transmitter. A tube-type final real tank circuit Pi network transmitter is amazingly forgiving. They are rugged as all hell, and you've got to do something pretty extreme to damage that one, Jim. So in that particular case, that particular transmitter, no antenna tuner is required for two reasons. One, it's so good at self-protecting, and two, it's one of those old-fashioned rig that has very large output tuning capability. It's only these new no-tune solid-state modern-day rigs that require an antenna tuner. So for two reasons you don't need it, your life's going to become a lot simpler. Now, whether or not you're able to make a QSO is a function of, is the band open? Is your antenna putting out enough power in that particular direction? Are you trying to make a contact during a pileup when everybody's looking for a TX station and some little old guy on Long Island is kind of ordinary to them and they're not going to answer? So there's a whole lot of reasons why your rig could be working beautifully, and at first you might not get an answer on your first attempt at HF of contacts, Jim. KD2BHY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
I think I'm going to give that a try tonight. Also, I have another question, if you have any time.
Yes, I do, Jim. I got to give you warning, Jim, that I think you're on a handy talkie, and as you move around, you go through dropout zones on your transmissions. When you get a chance, if you build yourself a very simple coat hanger wire ground plane antenna, a 2 meter ground plane antenna with a SO239 chassis mount connector as the way of mounting the four radials and the radiator, and if you hang that with a piece of string from the top of the radiator, where you put a little loop on the end of the radiator and you hang up from the string to the ceiling of whatever room is your favorite room with a piece of BNC cable coming down to your handy talkie, because of the extra altitude, you'll be louder. Because it's held in one position, you won't be fading in and out. So if you build that simple antenna, mounted in the highest place you can get in that particular room or some other room of the house, you'll be a hell of a lot louder. You can run lower power on the handy talkie. The battery will last longer. So I do recommend you consider that as a possible project. So go ahead with your second question. Try to choose a good location and sit still, because as you move around with your handy-talkie, you go into fades and we lose some of your words. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm actually doing that. I cut out all the pieces a few days ago of coat hanger wire, and I have the connector, so I'm actually doing that, and it's a lot of fun so far. I had a question about... It was about soldering, and whenever I solder, I know this is kind of a silly question, but whenever I solder, I tin the tip and I do everything that they're supposed to do, but whenever I solder, it doesn't really come out right, as in it's not really a dome of solder on the pad or whatever I'm soldering on. It's more of a bubble towards the top.
Wherever you were standing during that last transmission, you were nice and loud. Remember that spot. Go back to that spot. We make a joke about, you know, when you find a real good place to go fishing, you put an X on the side of the boat in that location so you can go back there. Now, that's a joke. So make sure you remember that spot. You sounded real good. Soldering is an art form. And in order for the thing that you're going to solder, for the solder to take to it correctly, there's about three things required. One, the thing that you want the solder to stick to has got to be super clean. You may have to rub it with steel wool or very fine sandpaper or something like that to make sure there's no copper oxide. Number two, if you get a chance to put the right kind of rosin solder, paste is not quite the right word, but there's a small container you can get where you put some of the rosin on the pad ahead of time, because that helps. Number three, when you're doing the soldering with the soldering iron, the thing that you want the solder to stick to must itself be hot enough to melt solder. If you can hold the tip of the soldering iron on the pad itself and then take the solder in your hand and touch it not to the soldering iron, but touch it to the pad that has become hot enough, then under those conditions, the solder will take a hell of a lot better. Now, you'll sometimes notice that a person who is very skilled at soldering will put a very small amount of solder on the tip of the soldering iron and touch the thing that he wants the solder to go to, and he's doing that only to have a very small amount of solder between the two that helps in the heat transfer. But once that heat transfer takes place, he's waiting for the pad, for instance, or the lead of the resistor or so on, to it to get hot enough so that when he touches the solder to the lead or to the pad, then the solder melts there, not on the soldering iron. So it takes a whole lot of practice of proper cleaning, maybe putting down some extra rosin, proper controlling of the heat, and so on. Soldering is, this is going to sound strange, it's a little bit like adult sex. You can't learn it all from a book. An awful lot of it comes from real experience, if you know what I mean. So when it comes to soldering on, you're just going to have to keep practicing on various pieces. But if you follow those rules of making sure there's no copper oxide, everything is super clean, and you make sure that the thing itself gets hot, it will help a whole lot. Even then, though, there's still other tricks that you will discover that work for you. Don't give up. Keep trying, Jim. KD2BHY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
All right. Thanks, Dick. Back to that. Thanks for answering those questions.
All righty. The next person on the list was Wes. And, Wes, you said you had a different question, a brief question than the more scientific ones. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Wes got called away. John, I guess it's time we go over to the mailbag and what kind of mailbag questions have we had so far this week. KC2, WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. Okay, Dick, yeah, we got it's a simple one. It's a construction problem. This gentleman, young man, 14, wants to know, when they make a wire-wound resistor, how do they make it non-inductive? It's made out of wire. Decent question. Maybe you can help him out. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you wind wire in a solenoid form, your straight-out piece of wire, very rough rule of thumb, will have inductance, roughly 22 nanohenries per inch, a rough rule of thumb often used by electronic engineers and technicians. When you wind it in a solenoid form, the inductance goes up 10 or 100 times faster. So a solenoid winding, because of the way the winding creates a magnetic field, the magnetic field links all of the turns of the winding, you get back EMF or increased inductance. There's a lot of different ways of explaining it. One technique that occasionally has been used that works medium well is that if you're going to wind a resistor, if you're going to wind a resistor in such a way that there's going to be two layers to the winding, and if you wind the first layer clockwise and the second layer counterclockwise, you will get reasonable amount of cancellation of the magnetic field from one winding versus the secondary winding. So that can definitely lower the inductance a whole lot. There probably are other ways of zigzagging the wire back and forth, somewhat like the way a filament is created inside of a cathode ray tube or of a vacuum tube. That would be quite a bit lower in inductance, but in other words, the wire is not wound in a round manner. It's wound in a straight side-by-side manner. In other words, you go up, let me pick a number, you go up 1 inch, make a 180-degree turn, come down 1 inch, make another 180-degree turn, go up another inch, and so on. That kind of zigzag wiring would have much, much lower inductance than a solenoid winding. Those are the two techniques I can think of. Let me drop. A third technique would be to choose nichrome or other kinds of wire that has a large amount of resistance per length, in which case very few turns would be required in order to make the resistor. So using very highly resistive materials that can tolerate high temperature is one approach. However, I'll admit you're not going to make a 50-watt resistor with that approach. So, in the case of the dummy load resistors that are used for a 100 watt heat skip type dummy load. There you've got a resistor with a very small length to it, and rather than burn up the resistor because it would be overheated, you've got oil flowing around the resistor, and the oil does an awful lot of the cooling without adding very much extra capacitance. So that's another way you can have a fairly low inductance, fairly high wattage resistor, which may be wire wound, but not necessarily. But the best one I know of is counter-winding, counter-rotational, you know, clockwise and counterclockwise between the adjacent layers of the resistor. I wonder if anyone else on frequency knows of other techniques of making a wire wound resistor with very low inductance. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening. Yeah, it looks like that's the best we can come up with tonight, John. There's also ways of making a volumetric resistor. If I started off with a volume of water, I remember when I was building my 500-watt transmitter that had a 2,000-volt power supply, and I had just completed the power supply, and I wanted to test it under working conditions, and I did not have a 500-watt dummy load. There's ways I could have hooked it up with light bulbs, I believe, although at 2,000 volts, that would be difficult. What I did was to take a large Pyrex bowl that my parents had, filled it up with water, and the next thing I was going to do is put two metal strips into the water, a positive lead and a negative lead, on opposite ends of this Pyrex bowl, and I was then going to pour salt into the water until I got the right amount of conductivity so that I would draw the right amount of current. Lo and behold, the water that came out of our well in our house at the time, an electric pump well living in Middle Island, had more than enough mineral matter in it. Let me drop. So that when I put the two metal probes into that jar of water, that bowl of water, immediately the conductivity was already a little bit too high. I never got a chance to add any salt. The next thing I did was to start extracting the metal probes that were in the water so that only a small tip of the probe was touching. And that started a whole series of very interesting experiments in which I was now arcing into the water with one of the metal strips, and as the water came up to boiling temperature and started making steam, and I'm arcing through that steam with one of these metal strips, and by the way, I was using very highly insulated rubber-coated wiring with rubber gloves and so on. You got to be very careful when you're running with a 2,000-volt power supply in a jar of water like that, in a bowl of water. There's all kinds of ways you can electrocute yourself. But as I was arcing the 2,000 volts through the steam on one of the electrodes above the water, I got all kinds of very fancy colored displays. I was making a kind of a plasma-like display. That's another whole set of experiments, but you got to be careful. That's a very dangerous experiment. So low inductance, very high power dummy loads, there's a lot of ways of doing it, and a wire-wound resistor is not necessarily the best way. I just don't think the dummy loads that we can buy are made out of wire-wound resistors. KC2WGB, wait for the all four beeps, K2RAW.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Well, the only non-inductive wire-wound resistors that I work with were made by GRW and Milwaukee Resistor Company. Milwaukee made the grid resistor, which was non-inductive, and all it was is basically something very similar to what you were indicating. You would have a series of loops up and down, and that could be wrapped around a ceramic core. So if you looked at it, if you started at a point on its length and traveled halfway around the diameter, and return, come back 180 degrees and go like 75% around, and return again back and forth, that's the style they had on the porcelain-based ones. And they were non-inductive, but kind of expensive, but almost any of those resistors that you described would give you enough of a non-inductive resistor to be able to use like in audio circuits and things like that. I have no idea what he has planned here, but that was his question. That sounds good.
about how many watts was that resistor that you just described? Go ahead.
One was 100,000 watts. Many of them were 10,000 watts. Most of them were 10,000 watts.